First, we examine one of the world's major institutions, which has just finished meeting, the UN Security Council. It was holding an emergency session on North Korea's latest missile launch, which proceeded despite the Council imposing strict sanctions earlier this week. It's probably aimed at defying them. In fact, the Council's press statement was very bold, condemning the launch and calling on North Korea to stop. Frankly, it's hard to imagine what else they might have said, which is exactly the question we'll examine now with a veteran observer and insider. Can the Security Council really prevent conflict, which is its essential remit? Ian Martin's visiting Australia for a United Nations conference in Canberra to coincide with the week acknowledging 70 years of Australian peacekeeping, mostly but not totally under the UN flag. On the North Korean sanctions, the Council was unified, but in the face of more labyrinthine conflicts like Syria, for instance, it's been chronically divided and arguably ineffective, promising a lot, delivering so much less, typified by vetoes and inaction over what's fairly clear were chemical weapons attacks on civilians in April. I welcomed Ian Martin earlier.
It's a great pleasure to be in Australia.
So this special meeting, what do you think it might discuss?
The pattern following each of the sort of provocative launches that North Korea has carried out has been for the Council to meet quickly and then issue a strong statement of condemnation and concern. But the actual negotiation of any action has usually taken longer and has essentially been a negotiation between the US and China, because there's absolutely no doubt that the effectiveness of sanctions on North Korea depends more than anything else on what China is willing to impose, what they're willing to vote for in the Security Council, but also what they're willing to apply in practice. And so that was the case with the recent unanimous resolution strengthening sanctions very considerably against North Korea. But although there was unity in the Council, that followed on quite a difficult negotiation between the US and China in particular, to some extent with Russia, before there was agreement on what all members would be prepared to vote for.
So, you know, if the stated aim is to prevent conflict, what's the point of the Security Council at this quite sort of pointy end of it, if I can put it like that, if really that's the realistic answer?
Well, from the very beginning of the Security Council, it's really always been the case that it required agreement amongst the major powers to be effective, and hopefully the Council would be a forum in which their positions would come somewhat closer together. And the United Nations went through the years of the Cold War when it was almost impossible to get that agreement, and therefore it isn't that it was completely ineffective, but it was only effective in the areas where the clash of great power positions didn't come into play so much. Then, of course, with the end of the Cold War, there was a period of great optimism when it seemed that there could be consensus among the permanent five members and the broader Security Council. But I'm afraid we're back in a more difficult period that has come from the disagreements over Syria, where there have now been eight vetoes by Russia in the Security Council. Six of them, but not all eight, supported by China, the Russian position supported by China. And it was also Ukraine, where the action taken against the Russians' takeover of Crimea that has led to Russia being, in general, very negative about sanctions and other forms of intervention. So I'm afraid it's not likely to be possible to look to the Council for political resolution where the leading permanent members are in strong disagreement. But that doesn't mean that the Council can achieve nothing. And actually, one of Australia's achievements when it was on the Security Council recently was, given the frustration of the elected members with the political disagreements over Syria, to at least get a humanitarian track going. And thanks to Australia, Luxembourg, and since then other elected members, the Council has at least been able to apply pressure, sometimes effective, for greater humanitarian access. That's not enough, of course, but where the most powerful members of the Council are really locked in disagreement, then it's very difficult to get an effective outcome from the Council.
So can elected members play a useful bridging role between permanent members in brokering some of these sorts of resolutions?
Yes, indeed they can. And I think the mood among elected members at the moment is that they need to be more assertive in that respect. And in some ways, the permanent five members, their positions are becoming more varied. One used to talk about the three Western permanent members, the US, UK and France, as likely to be in agreement on most things. China very often seeming to follow Russia in the council. Both those things are less certain. There are increasing disagreements between the US and France, for example, over peacekeeping operations in Africa, and China's increasing assertiveness and increasing closeness to the African countries on the Security Council means that, as we have sometimes seen on Syria, one can't assume that China will follow a lead from Russia. Indeed, China is becoming in many ways an increasingly powerful and assertive member of the Council. But that, I think, opens up a bit more space for the elected members. Now, the elected members...
Who are on rotation, aren't they, for 2 years?
They're elected for 2 years, that's right. And of course, they have as much ideological differences as the permanent five. But where the elected members do agree is that the council's decision-making can't and shouldn't be left just to domination by the permanent members. And there was a moment earlier this year, in relation to Syria, in fact, where the elected members were not prepared to be left out of the negotiations and just go along with what was drafted for them.
See, can I just interrupt? Even the former UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has expressed concern that the credibility of the UN had suffered as a result of the whole Syrian crisis. In an ideal but realistic world, Ian, what could have been possible from the Security Council?
Well, at the very early stages of the Syrian conflict, the council wasn't proposing a military intervention. It was prepared to be supportive of a plan that former Secretary General Kofi Annan put forward as a special envoy on Syria in order to move towards a political agreement and in the meantime have a ceasefire and an international role in maintaining a ceasefire. If the countries of the Security Council had managed to coalesce around that plan, then I hope we wouldn't be where we are today. But Kofi Annan, when he gave up his responsibility for mediation on Syria, did so saying that it was not so much because of the internal politics of Syria as because of the irresponsibility of different intervening countries and their inability to work together. So at the beginning, there was scope. I mean, when one's reached the point we have now, it's become harder and harder.
Well, in fact, your own report on whether the Security Council can prevent conflict suggests that a better emphasis would be to tailor solutions, to look at individual countries that are heading towards conflict. Maybe you could just expand on that, and is it likely?
Well, certainly the core job of the Security Council is to address as effectively as it can the country situations that are on its agenda. It's very reluctant to take up new situations, unfortunately, until they've become acute.
And that's one of the... Why?
Well, that's because of the divisions in the council around the questions of sovereignty and intervention. Again, it's particularly Russia and China that take a very strong position against what they would call interference in the internal affairs of other countries. And therefore, the upstream conflict prevention is quite difficult for the council. But I think we should bring into the conversation the role of the Secretary General, because when we're talking about what the UN can do to prevent conflict, in many ways, it really does start with the Secretary General, the mediating role he can play and through the envoys he appoints. And Secretary General Antonio Guterres has talked about a surge in diplomacy focused on conflict prevention with the object of, if you like, keeping countries off the Security Council agenda. Where the Council's responsibility is very strong is when a country's already on its agenda and it's trying to manage that conflict towards a sustainable solution, mitigate conflict, prevent relapse.
So, in effect, can you see any change coming, which might be related to different thinking about peacekeeping too? You know, are there new ways of thinking that might crack open this rather intractable set of issues you've described?
Well, there certainly is a very strong emphasis on the importance of conflict prevention now, and the new Secretary General has made that, I think, really the defining theme of what he seeks to accomplish. And we're at quite a defining moment in that too, because next week, and what is the leaders' week, the high-level week at the General Assembly, he has reform proposals out on the table that are designed to lead to the United Nations system being more integrated, more nimble in preventing conflict. So I think there's hope there, and he certainly has strong support from member states, in principle at least, in the importance of prevention. Everybody agrees that it's much more expensive to manage conflict through operations late in the day. The current US administration wants to cut peacekeeping budgets as much as it can. So one hopes that at least on the situations where the politics of the great powers are not locked into disagreement, the Secretary General can give a stronger lead to the system and to the Security Council. And I think there's something to hope for there.
And I notice, like, if we finish basically on this clear and present problem at the moment of North Korea, now the United States Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, he says Russia and China must take direct action over North Korea. I would have thought the Japanese might completely agree, given that things are landing near their country. By way of helping us decide whether to put any trust in it, in the Security Council, can you see some breakthrough there or not?
I think it's very hard to see that breakthrough, I'm afraid. It's hard to see how much further sanctions can go. Is China really prepared to strangle North Korea economically? Because it's only China that really has that ability to do so. And behind the apparent unity of the Council regarding sanctions, there is a big difference as between those who say that until there's some change from North Korea, one can't open up a dialogue.
And those because it rewards bad behaviour.
Exactly. And those who emphasise that even now efforts must be made to get back to six-party talks to dialogue, and the Security Council resolutions still nod in that direction of the importance of dialogue, and for Russia and China, that's still an emphasis that they want to press.
So should we temper expectations of the Security Council? Is that the takeaway from this?
Yes, I mean, certainly one has to be realistic that the Council cannot effectively address situations where the permanent members are in deep disagreement. That doesn't mean the Council's useless, because there are other situations it can address. It doesn't mean that the UN as a whole is useless, because the Secretary General and the other parts of the system can play an important role. But it's been the case from the very beginning of the Security Council and of the United Nations that it does depend upon a degree of great power agreement. And what one would like to see is more genuine dialogue rather than sometimes confrontational position taking in the Security Council.
We certainly would. Well, Ian Martin, good luck to you in your efforts. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.